Well, hello again. Welcome to the IC Company and Markets Show. I'm Mark Robinson. Unfortunately, our editor, John Heumann, can't be with us this afternoon. He's off on business somewhere. But I am joined by Bradley Gerard, our news editor, and three of our specialist writers, James Norrington, Emma Powell, and Harriet Russell. And ever reliable in the studio as ever is Dominic Toms. Well, it's been a traumatic week in markets, and that's probably an understatement as well. We've seen the FTSE, we've seen about $51 billion wiped off UK equity markets at one point. We've seen a range of commodity falls going on from those that have occurred over the last 18 months. Oil's down to about $28 a barrel. Key industrial inputs such as copper, iron ore and coal have again trading at or near multi-year lows, and it's fed through into a wider sell-off in markets as well. Looking at the news for this week as well, interestingly, the UK and Japan seem to have entered into a technical bear market. Rather unusual. Algernon Hall mentioned to me on the way down that this is the fourth one in his lifetime, and it probably didn't take markets completely by surprise, but the severity was unprecedented, really, over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been, it's obviously sort of made the start of 2016 even worse than it was prior to this happening. So both, as you say, the UK and Japan stock markets have fallen 20% since their cycle peaks. The UK, I guess the big pressure on the UK is, you know, oil stocks and commodity stocks, like you mentioned.
Well, that's right. It's heavily weighted within the benchmark and exactly, through the 350 as well.
Sentiment towards them is not very good. And as you say, oil's reached $28 a barrel. And in Japan, I suppose, Japan's got the problem of the fact that it's very much an exporter economy, but the safe haven asset when people are scared of equity markets is the yen. So you kind of have this effect, it's almost double whammy in Japan, whereby if people are scared of equities, not only are they selling them, but they're actually probably going into the yen, which makes Japanese exporters not as attractive.
Conversely, we've seen a little bit of weakness in sterling of late as well.
Yeah, we have. I guess, well, it's sort of a bit weaker against the dollar as that keeps strengthening, but it's also a bit weaker, I suppose, because there's not much movement in monetary policy as well.
There's been plenty of analyst comment as well saying that sterling was actually one of the most overvalued currencies during the rounds for quite considerable time there. I guess that's as much to do with QE and currency debasement elsewhere, but it's one to keep an eye on anyway. It's probably good news for a lot of the UK dividend income seekers, because so many of the FTSE 100 dividends are actually prefigured in US currency.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the currency situation isn't that bad at the moment, as you say, because the dollar's very strong, and if sort of dollars are declared in dividends but paid in pounds, and that's pretty good. So there are a few stocks in the FTSE that do that. I think I'll be right in saying Shell is absolutely one of those.
Yeah, Shell, BP. Yeah. I was going to say Anglo American then, but that's a moot point at the moment anyway. But most of the large resource companies, oil and gas stocks, certainly do as well. On the subject of oil and gas as well, it's also a week in which the final sanctions, or not the final sanctions, but the next to final sanctions being poured on Iran as well. So it sees them coming into the global oil markets with a near-term target of 500,000 barrels a day.
Yeah, more, I think, than they have been. So I think it's like an increase in production there.
Yes, it's an increase from where they were. And I think there's a long-term goal to push production up to 4 million barrels a day. But given that the infrastructure has been degraded so much over the last 10 years, it may take some time on that.
Yeah, I think historically, though, they're about the seventh largest oil producer or something. So if they're not that now, they probably do have a goal to at least sort of regain that sort of that level of output.
Well, exactly as well. It's an interesting, strangely enough, it opens up some opportunities for companies within the oil services sector as well, because, as I mentioned, the infrastructure there has been so degraded over the 10-year period that there's real opportunities there. If we move on to the next section within our news coverage, it's actually a piece that I've written there looking at some contrasting Q4 updates from BG Group and Royal Dutch Shell. Bradley, we've got a vote about a week from now, haven't we?
Yeah, we do. We've got, obviously, the as you say, the shareholder vote, which will either give the green light or the red light to this deal. It seems like, from what our personal finance team has written, that I think more people are in favour of it than not now. So it seems that
they've been speaking to a number of the institutional
A lot of the fund managers. So I think the barriers in the way to the deal are probably not so strong now, if they were there anyway. So yeah, it's quite an interesting piece. It's worth reading, and I won't go into it too much because the team might talk about it tomorrow on their podcast.
Well, yeah, suffice to say, I've come to the conclusion at the end that Shell are probably going to get the better end of the deal on this one as well, given that BG's latest Q4 production figures were wholly positive as well. This is, for many years, BG could do absolutely no wrong from the execution point of view. But then from about 2012, or slightly before that actually, they had a number of technical setbacks and political setbacks that were beyond their control, leading to a declaration of force majeure on their assets in Egypt. But since then, they've sort of managed to get their act together, and it looks like their big LNG project in Queensland is ramping up sufficiently well.
Yeah.
And they've also got some good news from the Santos Basin in Brazil too. So the whole idea behind, what we thought the whole idea, rationale behind the deal was Shell's desire to become more of an LNG play, aside from...
it seems like quite a shrewd move now, given... I know oil prices were falling at the time of the deal anyway, but not to the levels they've reached now, so I guess that diversification is quite sensible on Shell's behalf.
Yeah, it's a long-term objective as well, because they're seeing more and more power is being generated through natural gas. So anyway, we'll see what happens next week. There was a news spotlight that was written by our old friend Alex Newman this week, and you've had a look at this, haven't you, Bradley? It looks... looking at who might be the best plays going through the remainder of this year.
Yeah, I mean, Liberum basically held an event which Alex went to, and they were focusing on sort of small and mid-cap opportunities in the market, and looking at how actually they could be quite a good play at this point in the cycle, in spite of people thinking they're normally a bit more risky than sort of larger blue chip stocks. And they actually cite some of our buy tips, which is handy. Volution and SafeStore were both mentioned by Liberum, and Alex has obviously mentioned that in the article as well, so we've got something in common in terms of our view there with Liberum. I mean, obviously small caps, you know, they haven't survived the sell-off in UK equities at all by any means, but I think that the gist of Alex's piece is basically that there are there are more companies to choose from. They're not as well researched, but also the valuations aren't perhaps so steep as some of the larger companies as well. So, you know, that they're basically in a better position to grow, and some of the valuations are quite attractive.
Yeah, I think any of these advice, this sort of advice that I'm handy, taken in context with this week's events as well.
Yeah, it's worth noting that, absolutely. But I think, I suppose the growth opportunities of smaller companies, there's also the potential benefit that if they're smaller, they're perhaps just focused domestically or in fewer markets. So they're not sort of subject to the ravages of, you know, situations in other economies or currency, that sort of thing. So I think that can be a bit of a benefit as well.
Well, that'll be interesting, in, as I say, in the context of this week's events, which takes us on to our main feature for this week, which has been put together by James Norrington and Emma Powell, looking at how to identify possible short positions and how technically to go about it. So, James, we're looking at sort of shorting signals here, and also the tactics behind it. What were you trying to get out of the feature?
Quite innocently, actually, Mark. I was looking at
presciently, surely.
Presciently, yes. Well, you know, I've sort of. Although we've all, we've been thinking that the FTSE 100 has been looking overvalued for some time. We've all been aware of what's been going on with the chill winds coming from the east, from China, for a while. I think it's taken us all aback, the strength of the sell-off at the start of this week. So when this feature was written, it was actually, we were looking at more of a, for long-term buy and hold investors, how using the short interest that funds have towards certain stocks can be perhaps used as an indicator, as another part of the narrative around stocks when you're looking to buy or sell shares.
Okay, and so this is something that this type of strategy will be open to retail investors as well. Is it principally for people that are comfortable with highly technical trading strategies?
Well, I think Emma has gone into this in more depth with her part of the feature, where she's looked at various ways that investors can take a short position themselves. Emma will probably talk more about this herself. But actually, I suppose in the events of this week, I think the best thing for a lot of for most buy and hold investors to do is, if they have no immediate liquidity needs, is to stay invested and to ride out and to rely on a broad asset allocation to make sure that, you know, that their overall portfolio isn't harmed by too much peak to trough drawdown.
Yeah. Again, I say this is for people that don't have any need to sort of liquidate any of their holdings quickly for any particular reason.
Then there's an opportunity to hedge positions. If you're a sophisticated investor, there are methods to do that, which Emma's gone into. From my side of the feature, we've been looking at really. How short interest, just to explain it, is it's the percentage of shares that asset managers have a sell position of as a percentage of the shares outstanding. And that is, can be an indicator, an aggregate of the sentiment towards a company in the marketplace. So really what the feature is about is looking at how this level of sentiment in the market can help provide more colour around the decision to buy, sell or hold.
Okay then. Well, Emma, moving on to you. You've looked at the mechanics behind the short selling as well. Where did you go to first on this?
A good starting point, like James kind of mentioned, is that it is for, I think generally these strategies are for the more sophisticated investors, but something, the starting point in the feature from my side was very much, you know, we wouldn't recommend for private investors, you know, naked short selling or anything like that. The best way principally is through derivatives. So that could be contracts for difference or covered warrants, options. Those are the kind of instruments that you would use principally to hedge.
Okay.
To hedge and to try and obviously benefit from maybe market volatility, that kind of thing.
Well, we're likely to see an increase in that over the next few weeks and months, I would have thought.
I think we're looking at as you know, monetary policy, some discipline is going to come back into that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, things won't be driven by momentum of constant easy money being pumped into securities markets. So it's you know, investors are probably, you know, we're going to see more of a need to take a view on sort of hedging positions. If you look at, say, the ETF markets now as well, I was just at a Smart Beta conference this morning, and people were, and there are a lot more of the long short strategies coming out now. I think that hedging that to get returns, you know, I think we're going to be in uncharted territory for a while. We're going to be seeing it's still going to be difficult to get a good return on your money from cash savings or from bonds, and I think equities are, you know, the volatility is going to be greater over the next year or so, so for good risk adjusted returns, then perhaps more innovative strategies will be to the fore.
Okay, well, listen, it's a great piece. I take it, Amy, you can go along to the providers of CFDs, yeah, and all that, yeah, and they, you can always find, yeah, tutorials through these.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know the big providers.
We can't mention them here.
No, of course not. I wasn't going to do that. But actually, on James's point of using more innovative hedging strategies, that's actually just to mention, you know, when you're using some of these derivatives like contracts for difference, you know, short selling as a hedging strategy, you know, you can mirror, say you're long in a stock, obviously you can then go short in it, so yep, you know, you're bet on the market downside, which means, you know, it is that real hedging that you have, where obviously, you know, if the market and goes, if your market goes well, then obviously you've benefited as share prices have increased, but you do have that kind of safety net as well if you use an instrument like a CFD.
Okay, well, that seems to be the core of it, really, as part of a hedging or a defensive strategy.
Just one final point on hedging, Mark, is also important to look at the beta of your overall beta of your portfolio, i.e., you know, it's sensitive relative to its benchmark.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you will need, if you were to hedge through futures contracts, and the amount that you were to buy short futures contracts you were to buy, and would need to have a relative good rate, the correct ratio to your portfolio to give you the best hedging possible.
Oh, well, words of wisdom. Thanks very much, James. Thank you, Emma. The sector focus this week has been put together by Harriet Russell. And of course, this time of the year that we've got a virtual avalanche of trading statements from high street retailers. So Harriet's been taking a look at what trends have developed. And I guess it's more of the same, isn't it, Harriet?
Yeah, it is. I mean, there was a sort of hook for this piece was really a set of figures from the British Retail Consortium. What those really illustrated was that there were far fewer shoppers out and about on the high street. The numbers were down on November and down year on year, so it's just a constant fall. However, retail sales in general are up, so where are people choosing to spend their money? The short answer is online. That's not a new phenomenon, but it's ever more destructive.
And you make the point as well, it's many of us actually choose to shop online now, and I know I do personally, but that's through convenience, I guess, on my part. But there's also a price element to this now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a big problem, I think, for retailers, which some of them have failed to notice, which is they think it's makes more sense to offer the bigger discounts online, particularly around times like Black Friday, and then the promotions in store aren't quite as good. Their rationale behind that is that if we've got people in the store, they're likely to spend more because they'll see more items, they'll be more tempted, it's browsing, etc. Of course, what they don't realise is that customers sort of exiting from a recession are much more savvy than that, and they shop online first, they do all their research, and they click and collect it. That's growing ever more popular.
And of course, it's a lot of the traditional retailers now have I think the term that you use is fighting a battle on two fronts there, because they're having to actually build up their online presence, but maintain their place in the high street as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's for the clothing retailers in particular, that's a huge problem because their business has been hugely disrupted by the likes of ASOS and Boohoo and other online fast fashion retailers. And obviously, I'm not saying that ASOS and Boohoo don't have overheads. They obviously have to maintain a huge distribution network that deals with massive volumes. But to compete, someone like Next, for instance, or even Ted Baker and Supergroup, French Connection, they're all having to fight on two fronts because they've got an existing store estate that has its own sort of property liability attached. And then they're having to set up these distribution networks, some of them from scratch. Next did relatively well off that because they had existing Next directory, which insulated them for a number of years against those rising costs. But, you know, other groups have had to really pour a huge amount of money into expanding their online distribution just to keep up.
Yeah, I guess Next provide a prime example, really, because they were standalone in the market for a decade and a half, really, and yet they've had to evolve their business now.
Yeah, absolutely. For a long time, Next was very often compared to Debenhams, and Debenhams had to, as I say, set up this distribution network really from scratch, whereas Next had their existing directory business to really help them sort of get their feet off the ground and able to compete for a while. But the trading statement from Next at the beginning of the year was not good, frankly. The shares have derated quite substantially since the end of last year. They have a good track record. It depends how much sort of weight you want to put in past performance being an indicator of future performance, but they have a good track record in terms of shareholder returns, things like that. So I suspect it will still be a popular stock going forward as long as they can turn trading around quarter to quarter.
Well, as you say, it's been a mixed bag across the retail spectrum so far this year. But I guess we'll have to wait until April time once we've got all the financials through to just see what the impact has been. Because obviously there's the popularity of online shopping also feeds through into the gross margin as well.
It definitely does. I think there are going to be some significant events this year, such as the introduction of the new living wage. That's going to push up costs again for a number of retailers. Maybe not this year, it's being introduced this year, but you know, a lot of them do already pay their staff quite generously, so they'll be able to absorb the cost initially. But going forward, yeah, those margins are going to come under pressure because the costs are going to rise. Now it'll be up to those retailers to decide how they offset that. Some companies like Wetherspoons, which is obviously a pub company, has taken margin hits for years because they don't want to destroy their value offering to customers. They want to keep prices where they are. Next has already hinted that it may well have to increase prices, not dramatically at first, but it says it is prepared to do that.
Okay, well, listen, it's a great piece, and there'll be a companion piece, no doubt, in about 3 months' time once we get all those figures through anyway. But that's it for this week. There's a host of other good reading in the magazine as well, A Contrarian's Conundrum and the Four Best Investment Trusts and Four Shares That Nearly Have It All. But until next week, I'm Mark Robinson. Goodbye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.